At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. Gavin Williamson has sent a letter. We'll try to decode the contents. Super complaints are on the horizon. We have some Turing details. And Chris Skidmore is back. It's all coming up.
You know, I mean, the messaging for me is quite clear and has been for some time. They want fewer people to go to university. And I guess they want to kind of turn it back into a kind of a high level, high status academic top slicing and push everyone else into, you know, level 4 and 5 courses elsewhere.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us work out whether to risk booking a summer holiday this year. As ever, we have two fabulous guests. In Oxfordshire, Mary Kernop-Cook is a higher education expert and serial non-exec director. Mary, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, morning, everyone. Well, I've done a couple of events this week on a new platform called Clubhouse. I don't know if either of you have come across it yet, but basically it's Zoom without the video. In other words, a conversation that you can have without your lipstick on. And it's different and it's a bit more sort of laid back. I had a great conversation about young people taking on portfolio careers from an early age rather than at my sort of age and how they need different preparation for that possibility. I think it's an interesting way of having a conversation. And so check out Clubhouse at an app store near you.
Clubhouse, how fascinating. Right, I'll be right onto that. And in London, Stephen Spear is Vice Chancellor at Kingston University. Stephen, your highlight of the week.
Well, I've been, my professional and personal background is in the creative industries, and I've been very concerned for a few years about a series of measures that pull out support for education in the creative industries, although it's the fastest growing sector of the economy. And so I got a piece about that published in Creative Review that asks if the government is really joining itself up. It's, you know, Biz is saying one thing about an industrial strategy and the DfE is doing another.
Well, excellent. And that, you know, can very much recommend the piece. We'll put a link in the show notes if you haven't seen it. So, good. We start this week with some regulation news. Secretary of State for Education Gavin Williamson has written to the Office for Students setting out a selection of strategic priorities. Mary, was this a poisoned pen letter?
Oh, God. It's pretty long, 7 pages. And it starts with what I thought was a slightly mealy-mouthed thank you to Michael Barber and welcoming Lord Wharton, the new chair of the OFS. And it covers just about everything you can think of. We've got mental health, financial sustainability, smooth admissions this summer, quality and standards, which of course must be driven up as soon as possible, PQA, reduction in bureaucracy, watch out for recruiting too many people from China, bit of anti-Semitism, free speech / academic freedom, and so on. I thought it also says that they want the sector to interpret the government's formal response to the Pearce review as the strategic guidance about what to do with TEF. And so I reread that as well. And interestingly, when you read the government's response to the TEF, it says they'll set out more details in their strategic guidance. So there's a little circular path to go around there if you're interested. Mixed messaging about free speech and academic freedom will apparently be much clearer in a future policy paper on the topic. I think Gavin Williamson, I don't think, was quite convinced by Michael Barber's recent speech on the topic, and he wants OFS to take much more active and visible action in this space. So, wait with interest on that one. I'm a bit concerned about access and participation. There's an emphasis on high quality courses and not just more students on low quality courses, as they call them. So I think no more bums on seats unless they're disadvantaged, and high quality and an emphasis on cold spots and white working class boys, which is music to my ears, as you'll appreciate. Urging schools again to work with schools to raise attainment, and this phrase, equality of opportunity, not outcome, which we might want to talk about. I think basically we've got further signalling of a change of focus from widening participation towards fair access at the top end of the sector, which after all is where the biggest gaps are. The other eye-catching idea in this letter is the possibility of revoking degree awarding powers at subject level. So I had to think about that, and I thought it probably wasn't a very student-centric thing to do. And, oh, well, this is just, you know, it's another set of messaging that tells us basically that the government doesn't want more people to go to university unless it's kind of top proper universities. You know, read all this alongside the Skills for Jobs white paper, high-quality alternatives and so on. And you know, the big question is, will the alternatives be high enough quality so that we don't just end up with the middle classes continuing to go to uni and the rest being diverted to, I don't know, level 4 and 5 outcomes at FE colleges? But I don't know where you want to start on this one. We could pick almost any higher education topic.
It's a good question. So, Stephen, this thing about, you know, low-quality courses, the OFS, you know, subject level kind of, you know, baselines, and then this this kind of extension of the threat in the letter telling OFS to think about, I'm not even sure if they can do this legally, but revoke degree awarding powers at subject level based on these baselines. I mean, where do you think this will go next, and what will that do to HE if it all comes true?
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, the letter does read like it's written by a former chief whip, doesn't it? So that's unfortunate. And it is, as Mary's described it, it is rather contradictory in places. On the one hand, the OFS is supposed to be lighter touch and more risk-based, and yet in certain areas, it's supposed to be much more interventionist. And there are some things in there which are highly political, or rather touch buttons for a certain part of the political class. So I do worry that the OFS is becoming increasingly politicized. It is supposed to be an independent regulator. The appointment of the new chair, of course, is a highly political appointment, and the letter is really pushing a lot of buttons that will play to a certain segment of the political establishment.
Yeah, I mean, Mary, the other thing that blew up this week was Labour noticed that James Wharton was a political appointment. and, you know, I actually stuck a press release out and got a bit of press coverage. But, you know, having a highly political appointee chairing a regulator that doesn't really intervene in some of the ways that the letter suggests, particularly on freedom of speech, he's going to get caught in the middle, isn't he, between two very different kind of, you know, sets of views about what OFS is for.
Yeah, I think so. Having said that, you know, this is what happens, isn't it? You know, the party in power, you know, will put its own people who support broadly its policy directions into those positions. So I don't think it's that strange, really. I mean, you know, whether he has to resign the whip or not, to me, it doesn't make much difference, because he's going to vote with the Conservatives anyway, isn't he? I think that, you know, the question will be, is can he establish himself as a thoughtful and balanced regulator in the sector, while obviously having to, you know, try to follow the strategic guidance from the department. And, you know, he's got lots of opportunities to do that. So, you know, watch out for his first speeches and his first interventions.
Stephen, do you think we're any closer to understanding what a, you know, low quality or low value course is as a result of any of this stuff?
Not really. although, well, except there's clear indications in there that because he supports the use of absolute metrics, which the OFS has been developing, which take no account of where a student is starting from in terms of their attainment. So that is a pretty clear indication, as Mary was suggesting, that that'll drive a lot of decisions by universities about who they take. And clearly, clearly we're trying to get more people to choose FE instead of HE. So, well, and I support the idea that FE should be an attractive option for people. But there's a lot of professional vocational education that is done by universities, and that seems to be not understood by the DfE, and certainly in the letter. So there seems to be this binary thinking between the research intensive universities and FE But, you know, who's educating the nurses, the teachers, you know, a good part of the engineers that go into industry? You know, it's not happening at either end of those poles. And I'm kind of looking for some support for those kinds of universities, of which Kingston is one of them. And I'm struggling to find it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the letter does read, doesn't it, Mary, as if there's making, you know, applications to elite universities fairer. I mean, he actually says some, you know, words to that effect when he's talking about the way in which he's grabbed hold of the admissions review. And then, you know, more vaguely talks about the way in which the sector might support his white paper reforms. But there is this massive kind of gap, isn't there, in everything that comes from the government about, you know, vocational and technical HE that is happening in HE now.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help feeling that there's, you know, without actually saying it out loud, they're kind of trying to unpick the 1992 reforms that made the polytechnics into universities. You know, they found themselves with higher education being massified, you know, with whatever it is, close to 50% of young people going to higher education, and basically they can't afford it. And that, you know, they want more people to do things that are less costly to fund, and indeed that get outcomes that are economically useful, particularly post-Brexit and post-COVID. So, you know, I mean, the messaging for me is quite clear and has been for some time. They want fewer people to go to university. And I guess they wanted to kind of turn it back into a kind of a high level, high status academic top slicing and push everyone else into, you know, level 4 and 5 courses elsewhere. Now, the main problem with that, of course, is that it won't cure the so-called academic vocational divide. It won't get parity of esteem. It'll make it worse. And I think it'll just drive a class divide between the middle classes who will continue to try to send their children to university and kind of everyone else who does something else, which might also be valuable, but I don't think serves a kind of an equality agenda. So I think this is kind of tough for them because they're really trying to unpick, you know, the last 25 years of reforms and what most of us would think of as progress.
Mm. And Stephen, there is this other line in there, isn't there, that Mary highlighted about, you know, equality, where he says, I would like to remind the OFS that it has a statutory duty to have regard to the need to promote equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. You know, I said at our event the other day, and he was referencing the Liz Truss speech, and I, you know, I said at our event the other day, given Michael Barber has just spent 3 or 4 years setting up a regulator that he's obsessed only with outcomes, it's quite a thing to write a letter saying, I'd like to remind you not to focus on outcomes and only to focus on opportunity. But, you know, could this signal, you know, a completely different approach on access and participation? Or is this just a bit of, you know, kind of political saber rattling?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, the sector's been working to outcomes for some time now. You know, for students, it's about learning outcomes. We are increasingly measured with, you know, not about on access, not just about getting people in. That's why I don't like the term widening participation. It's actually getting them out and getting them out with a good degree and good skills. So in that sense, you know, I mean, I support the government's objective there to ensure that, you know, students in university, no matter their background, get a good education. So, but we are starting to, as you suggest, you know, talk about inputs versus outputs, and you know how you get a student there is that's the art, isn't it? I mean, that's where, you know, universities will do different things, and some universities will take those undergraduate education more seriously. Some are much better at providing a good education to students from disadvantaged backgrounds than others. I mean, that's the variety and the richness in the sector. And that's why outcomes-based measures are right. So as long as they also take some account of where you're starting from, you know, you want to close the attainment gap. That attainment gap is an issue that starts already, you know, when the child is born.
Yeah. Actually. And Mary, just quickly on freedom of speech and well, the Chaucer clause. So he obviously doesn't mention Chaucer or Leicester, but I mean, there's a big Chaucer and Leicester sticker in the letter. And let's just remind ourselves what he says. So he says, I honestly have to say, I think this, you know, DK reckons that this letter isn't very well drafted. I think this paragraph is a work of art, right? So the paragraph, just let's just remind ourselves, says, while providers are rightly free to determine the content of their courses, university administrators and heads of faculty should not, whether for ideological reasons or to conform to the perceived desires of students, pressure or force teaching staff to drop authors or texts that add rigour and stretch to a course. OFS should robustly challenge providers that have implemented such policies and clearly support individual academics whose academic freedom is being diminished. I mean, what on earth do we make of that couple of sentences?
Oh, God. This is such complex territory. And I think I'm with you. You know, these are kind of tricky things, not just the free speech and academic freedom stuff, but the rest of it, you know, which I agree. I don't think the government has found a very convincing voice about how to express what it's really trying to do. So everything comes sort of slightly shrouded and difficult to unpick. But my thinking is that they're on a real hiding to nothing on this one, because freedom, academic freedom is kind of ensconced in law, isn't it? And I'm not sure the regulator has the authority to intervene in that way.
Stephen, I'm particularly taken with the line, you know, the bit where he says universities shouldn't conform to the perceived desires of students. Now, outside of the specific, you know, Leicester case, I thought the whole point of running a sort of market in HE was to conform to the perceived desires of students. So are we supposed to impose courses on students?
That and the last topic, just some of the contradictions in the letter, aren't they? You know, it is called the Office for Students, after all, and we're about to clearly scrap the NSS, which is, a national annual student voice, actually. So it is quite contradictory. And as far as academic freedom goes, I thought that was rather shockingly populist, those three paragraphs. And not evidence-based. Even the way it's written talks about, you know, reported incidents. And, I mean, where are these reported incidents? And how many are there? And it's the same thing with the paragraph about anti-Semitism. It seems that, you know, it seems to be a problem, but we're asking the OFS to look into whether it is a problem. That's the worrying thing, that there are really quite populist sound bites in here, which really are beneath the dignity of a regulator to look at. You know? Yeah, the shame about the letter is that it rather confuses or obscures the central government agenda, a lot of which I support. You know, we should be raising the stature and the quality of FE. We should be addressing the skills gap. And we should be looking in higher education at outcomes rather than inputs. You know, we should be ensuring the students can continue, guaranteeing a degree quality, that they're getting the skills that they need to go out and prosper in the world.
And Mary, just before we come, you know, just before we move on, I mean, the other thing that's mentioned in here is the admissions review, which, you know, I said on the site earlier on in the week, two strategic letters in a row, ministers were saying, we're really pleased to see that OFS is running an admissions review. Good, all power to your elbow. Do keep us in the loop. Now, of course, DfE has just taken over the admissions review and is instructing OFS to help out with its review. That's all a bit of a mess, isn't it? Where, you know, who's looking after admissions policy?
Well, I think it is. And of course, let's just say that the DfE consultation comes out with a consensus about what to do next. Who has the power to make that happen? It's really unclear. You know, in the past, it's always been a sort of gentleman's consensus between UCAS and the universities to make changes to the admissions service. So it's not at all clear to me who decides what should happen next and who has any power to enforce it. But more than that, I bear the scars, Jim, as you'll remember, from about 10 years ago doing what I thought was a really thorough piece of work on whether PQA could be implemented and how it would be implemented. And we did a consultation which the sector answered, with huge conscientiousness and real thought, which made me change my mind about whether PQA would be the right solution. What I don't see in the current consultation, you know, is enough about how this process impacts on all the various players in the system. It isn't just about universities and students. It's about exam boards and exam markers. It's about regulators. It's about schools and colleges and students and parents. I mean, one of the things, by the way, that surprised us when we consulted on PQA 10 years ago was that actually parents said, hang on, we want to go on holiday in the summer as well. You know, it wasn't just... All of that, leaving all of that aside, the real problem about this is that PQA has become the solution. And instead, we should be saying, you know, what changes need to be made to improve the prospects for disadvantaged students? Because, you know, everything rests on predicted grades being the enemy of the peace. And actually, I think... there's plenty of analysis around, and I hope will be published soon on a series of essays that HEPI's publishing, you know, saying that predicted grades probably do far more good for disadvantaged students and widening participation than harm. You know, so I think there's an outside chance that the DfE will get a bit of a bloody nose on this consultation, because when people really start to think about it, they realise that this isn't going to fix very much, and it's actually going to create many more problems than it solves.
Well, exciting stuff. And if you'd like to engage more in this debate about the future of admissions, our Wonky at Home event on the 2nd of March, The Future Shape of Admissions, you can book now on wonky.com/events, where you'll find an agenda and details of speakers. Good, right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name's Graham Atherton. I'm director of the National Education Opportunities Network, or NEON. This piece is about the forthcoming proposed changes to the Level 3 qualification landscape. This move to a binary A-level, T-level system, cutting out BTEC, could spell real bad news for widening access to higher education. The piece I've just recently written is based on a report we released this week, which shows that around a quarter of students entering HE, or young students are entering HE, from the low participation neighbourhoods are entering with either A-levels and BTECs or BTECs alone. Alongside this, we did a survey of nearly 50 of our members in NEON and showed they're very, very pessimistic and concerned about what's going to happen when we shift to BTECs. Away from BTEC, and the impact it's going to have on widening access. They believe that the students that take BTEC, the widening access students, that will not be able or willing to take A-levels, and T-levels won't provide an option for them. So certainly this could set widening access back some years, unless we see, hopefully, some change. But I'm not sure optimistic we are on that one.
My name is Susanna Kalatowski, and I'm Head of Policy at University Alliance. This week, I wrote about the fact that the two centrepieces of the government's HE policy, tackling low-quality courses and increasing flexible lifelong learning, are increasingly at odds. It didn't have to be this way. They're not inherently contradictory. The problem seems to come down to the fact that DfE and the OFS think the best way to assess quality is to focus on student outcomes, namely continuation, completion, and progression. These outcomes are unevenly distributed across different groups of students, subjects, and employment sectors, and they're closely correlated to entry tariffs, socioeconomic background, and geography. It's difficult to see how flexible provision can flourish in this landscape. If you ask universities why they don't offer more of it, conversation quickly turns to the test. Continuation and completion rates for modules and short courses tend to be lower than for full-time courses. With the pandemic-induced recession meaning even more people will need to upskill and retrain, it's arguably never been more important to properly invest in and incentivize flexible provision. University Alliance and many others have been calling for this for some time, but the government's relentless focus on narrow student outcomes, particularly if they are not benchmarked, means there's a real risk that universities will be discouraged from embracing this agenda. The approach to regulating HE quality needs to change for flexible provision to truly take off.
Now, the Office of the Independent Adjudicator has been out this week putting the finishing touches to a new process for mass complaints. Stephen, what's going on here?
Well, indeed, what is going on here? The office, the OIA is the last stop for student complaints. So every university has a very evolved complaints procedure, and you would hope that everything or most everything could get resolved within a university and not go to the OIA. And now we seem to be opening up the door to the OIAs going around all of that to look at mass complaints. So I am a little bit confused about what they're doing. Well, the role of the OIA is really to ensure that the university has followed its own procedures, and indeed that those procedures are robust and appropriate. So, and until now, that has been individual student cases. So you know, a group complaint is I don't know quite how the OIA is going to deal with that, because that will presumably have gone around the university's own procedures. It'll cut across various universities. I'm not sure the OIA is the right venue for any of that. It might be the OFS. It could be the DFE, depending on what the complaint is. But I'm not sure the OIA is the right place for that.
Mary, you know, I'm not. I'm definitely not Felicity Mitchell. But I guess what OIA would say would be, look, you know, pragmatically, we reckon there's going to be a huge number of complaints that are really similar, so we may as well try and deal with them in groups. But are there unintended consequences, do you think?
There probably are. But I mean, if I'm thinking about the students who I think on the whole have had a pretty rotten time through no fault of their own, and actually probably through no fault of most universities either. And it does seem to me that there's a reasonable case for, you know, kind of a class action, if you like, for students to say, hang on, you know, we paid for one thing and we've got less than that in some way. It seems to me kind of a reasonable approach. Now, I haven't looked into the ins and outs of how the OIA is proposing to do it, but I think, you know, the university sector certainly doesn't want to be kind of tied up in hundreds of thousands of individual complaints if a kind of a group approach to it would come to a sort of reasonable settlement, if indeed students have a reasonable grounds to have any kind of compensation. So I think on the whole, I think this is good for students. I think back to my own kids. You know, even now, they would kind of struggle to kind of engage with a process like this. And I think it's really hard for young people to kind of figure out what to do if they have got a complaint. And I guess the student union, the NUS and others will have a big role to play in all of this. So I think on the whole, I'm kind of pro the idea of being able to kind of look at this in the round, rather than just, you know, leaving hundreds of thousands of cases going through the system over a number of years, and perhaps coming out with a kind of a sector-wide settlement of some sort. But maybe that's heresy to Stephen and
well,
and Jim. I don't know.
But, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously OIA, and it does say this in the document, OIA can't look at things, you know, across the sector. Actually, it's not going to look at mass complaints from a sort of cross sector point of view. What it can do is, you know, bunch them together in institutions. But I mean, that's, you know, are we heading towards something strange here? So, Stephen, you know, your president, what's his name, Faisal, you know, if he's got, you know, if president of the Students' Union, if he's got, you know, 2,000 students saying, you know, I don't know, you know, Kingston promised me X and I didn't get it, and, you know, you're going, well, you know, it's been a pandemic and, you know, this is what we said to you last summer in terms of, you know, what we're changing restrictions. Wouldn't it be odd if someone from Reading, from OIA, turns up and then referees this row? I mean, that would be strange, wouldn't it? But it feels like that's where we're heading.
Yes, students have obviously had a very difficult time at university. This, you know, it is not during a pandemic. They've not had the experience in the round that they would have wanted or would have expected. That is true. So, and the same would go for university staff. And, you know, universities have tried very hard under very trying circumstances to give students a good education and a good experience. But, you know, this is not the way you would prefer to go through university or to run a university. That is obvious. But for the real complaint, I mean, that's the real complaint for the students. You know, on a And that, I think, pushes the whole issue into a different realm, which is not about the OIA, which is about compliance with your regulations, compliance with what you said. You know, are you complying with the Competition and Markets Authority? You know, that's all the kind of legalese part of it. The real issue, of course, is political, it seems to me. And that is why I think that this is the wrong venue for this conversation. You know, are the students, what could be the possible remedies for the students to get around these? And I think most of those remedies sit with the government, or more specifically, probably with the Treasury. You know, there was the call from, I think it was 7 vice chancellors, that, you know, you could forgive the interest on the loan payments, for instance. I mean, what is a possible remedy from the OIA, unless you actually did break a promise? But I would think that the OIA, which is, you know, quasi legal, I would doubt that they will be able to find in the favor of the students on a legal basis.
Yeah, a sensible way through what in the end is a kind of big political problem. Mary, you know, if you were looking across the piece and you were saying to yourself, right, I now have the power to, you know, solve the grievances that collectively students have, what would your magic wand do?
Yeah, well, it's a tough one, isn't it? You know, and you only need to think back to the pensions strikes. You know, when universities were saying, hey, you know, you're paying for more than just teaching, and now we're saying, well, you know, you're getting the teaching, so don't worry that you haven't got the rest of it. I really think universities are in a difficult place here, because some of them might think that the right thing to do is to make some sort of financial compensation against fees, you know, even though that wouldn't make a huge amount of difference to most students in terms of repaying their student loans. But they can't do that, because that would be an admission that they'd not been delivering quality. And, you know, the regulator will then kind of beat them over the head with a stick. So for me, yes, I agree with Stephen. It is political, and I think it's a, you know, it's another manifestation of the sort of general unpopularity of the university sector, that the government hasn't been prepared to step in and do something which, you know, goes some way to compensating students for what is undoubtedly a lesser experience than they feel that they were signing up for and paying for. But helping universities, you know, who would take a very big financial hit if something like this came along. So I'm kind of still holding out hope that maybe the government will do something, but maybe I should not wait.
Hope springs eternal.
One of the contradictions, and this is the problem with the OIA being involved, is that universities are independent entities, and yet the pandemic, of course, has been a global problem. So there is a sector-wide issue here, and it can't be dealt with by individual universities. You know, I mean, that each university decides by itself what it's going to do or what it could do. So it does seem that the government needs to sit down with the universities and find a way, you know, can we somehow address the grievances by the students? You know, I mean, you know, we've done a fantastic job. We spent a huge amount of money, by the way, to try and give the students a good education, a good experience. But it is not a normal university experience. It just cannot be. But that is a national problem that probably needs a national conversation between the government and the universities.
Well, fascinating stuff. We'll obviously keep up to date with developments on the site. Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
If you were to pitch up at an English university in the middle of the 19th century and ask to see the research facilities, you would be very disappointed, because there were none. Firstly, the universities were mostly concerned with non-experimental sciences, so you wouldn't be shown to any great laboratories. There were some laboratories that students were allowed to do things in. But original research was not, even in the humanities, something that they thought was important. So much so that if you go to the work of Cardinal Newman, his very important lectures on the idea of the university, he's quite dismissive of the idea of generating new knowledge. If the object of a university was scientific and philosophical discovery, I do not see why a university should have students. He's very clear that it's not any of their business. And certainly there are plenty of examples, and Oxford does very well at coming up with these examples, of why universities shouldn't do research, they shouldn't do science, this isn't their business. Discovery of knowledge is nothing much to do with them. So one of the great reformers of the University of Oxford is the Master of Balliol, Benjamin Jowett, and he's a great idea that he reforms all sorts of things at university. He's hated by some conservatives, but one of the things he's very clear on is that research is not the kind of thing that his university should be doing, because it threatened the whole tutorial and examination system, which was making Oxford into the highest of high school for boys. So for him, it was a really bad thing, and he came up with this idea, someone talking to him. Research, the master exclaimed. Research, he said, a mere excuse for idleness. It has never achieved and will never achieve results of the slightest value. So this is the head of Balliol, very clear that this is not something that should happen. Clearly, there's an ongoing movement. There's what you get is this interaction between the new universities, places like Manchester, who start to borrow the apparatus of the research university, which is developed in the US and developed from Germany, and they work out that actually useful knowledge is A, useful to the locale, but actually is generating new things. So they both do what we might think of as applied, but also basic research. So you start to get a development. Cambridge sets up the Cavendish Laboratory in 1874 and gets an extraordinary range of people who come. Nobel Prizes developed very quickly. The fundamentals of the universe are understood by people at Cambridge. This idea that we should advance knowledge is now seen as something that we should get on to do. There's an association with Lord Kelvin, who's at Glasgow University for an extraordinary amount of time, but this is a man who perfects underwater cables, who does temperature, who does all sorts of things, polyglot of thinking about what a university should be doing, discovering things. But in other places, this is still seen as definitely a bad idea, and it only really finally gets cemented after the First World War, when the useful knowledge that universities have contributed towards the war is actually seen by both government and by society as something that is worth reflecting. And it certainly wins the argument finally in Oxford that, university research is the kind of thing that they should be doing, and they start to set up the major facilities that they have, and it really kicks on from there.
Good. Now, as we record, it's Thursday and it's the spring, or at least it's the early part of the year. So a fresh batch of data is out from HESA this week on widening participation, the UK performance indicators data. DK has done a dive.
The curious thing about the HESA UK performance indicators is how old-fashioned they now feel. The time-honoured and respected use of a benchmark now clashes oddly with the absolutism now expressed in the Quality and Standards Consultation. Compared to the microfidelity of the Access and Participation Dashboard data, the simplicity of the old Polar Quintile 1 versus the rest approach is surprisingly blunt. Even Polar now feels like a first draft of Tundra, or a poor proxy for indices of multiple deprivation. So what's the use of UKPIs? Well, the other one still gets used in TEF, but that's kind of outside the scope of this segment. The widening participation UKPI still remains, for me, the best way of understanding how an individual provider is serving low participation groups. The best way to do this is comparing against the benchmark. There's actually two benchmarks here, of course. The regular one looks at entry qualifications and subject areas, and there's an even nicer one that adds region of domicile. All of these link participation to socioeconomic capital and the compulsory sector education, factors that we know determine more of the course of a life than we might be comfortable with. The idea of HE as a truly life-changing experience is actually quite hard to back up in the data. Now, as well as an established and sadly England-only KPI, the Office for Students has got a KPM, a key performance measure that looks at young participation by Polar Quintile 1 at the most selective of providers. The projections behind this KPM, taking into account targets expressed in provider access and participation plans, would see the participation gap between Polar Quintile 1 and Polar Quintile 5 disappear entirely. We are not given details of the 31 English high tariff providers that are used in this calculation, so I used the Russell Group as a proxy. Here we see that just 6.69% of the 2019-20 young undergraduate intake were from Polar Quintile 1. This is up, admittedly, from 6.55% last year and 6.51% the year before. So things are improving, but to me, at least, not fast enough. All the graphs behind this are in an article on Wonky, and you can track the performance of any provider against their benchmarks.
Good, and finally, former Universities Minister Chris Skidmore popped up in Parliament this week to chat SA Mills. Let's have a quick listen.
Time and time again, in this dark underworld of SA Mills and the companies that seek to make a profit out of the insecurity and desperation of students, the common theme that emerged was of exploitation. Exploitation of students, particularly vulnerable students under pressure to do well in their studies, and students who are first in the family to attend university, on whom the pressure to succeed is immense. International students away from home for the first time. Not to mention exploitation of graduates abroad, some of the poorest countries in the world who are being forced to work 12-hour shifts writing essays for $1 an hour. Exploitation of graduates and students at home, so desperate for extra money that they are selling their essays for £10, which in turn will be sold on for £300.
Stephen, what do we do about contract cheating?
Ban essay mills. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Ireland is banning them, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. Universities do what they can. We educate students what plagiarism is. We have all sorts of mechanisms to try and catch it. But, you know, these essay mills are profit-driven, and they are constantly trying to find ways around what we do. It's a cat-and-mouse situation. So I think if other countries can ban them, why can't we?
Yeah Mary, on one level, surely we should just ban these things. But are they bannable? I mean, you know, most of them operate offshore, don't they? I mean, this is... won't they just find their way back in somehow, you know?
Well, maybe, but banning them, I think, is a must, and it's been done elsewhere, as Stephen said. By the way, I bought an essay online a couple of years ago. it was, you know, when the first kind of flurry of people calling for bans on essay cheating websites came up, and I commissioned an essay on
contract cheating,
whether you could successfully from a legal point of view, whether there was a legal case for banning them. And I got I paid my 150 quid or whatever for a 2-1 standard essay, and I got the argument back. I couldn't find it in time for this recording, but the reality is, if you engage with these sites, it is very clearly a service to help people cheat. And the fact that it's there means that a student, you know, who's under pressure and coming up to a deadline might, instead of going to their tutor or whatever and saying, look, I'm under pressure, can I have some more time? They might go and buy an essay. And I think if it's more difficult to do that and they're more scared of getting caught, then they'll be less likely to go down that path. Because I suspect that once you've done it once, it sort of becomes easy to get hooked on it. So I really hope that Chris Skidmore's intervention, it would be a pretty easy thing to do. And the big question is, as you said, Jim, would it work? I mean, one of the things that always annoys me as well is that Turnitin, the anti-plagiarism software, is used by essay mills to guarantee that the essays they write for their customers aren't going to get caught by plagiarism. So I think it'd be good if Turnitin and other similar sites stopped making their service available to these nefarious services.
Stephen, more broadly, aren't we in a weird kind of arms race here? Because, at some point, surely the technology and the AI is going to get to a point where, cheating becomes undetectable. Don't we have to look at assessment itself rather than, this kind of arms race on trying to stop, people copying?
Well, I think in the short term, you just have to... into this arms race, as you've suggested. I mean, the irony of it, Turnitin is profiting from both ends of this is just incredible, isn't it? But I don't know. Is it really? I mean, most of us have mixed assessments. So there would be essays, there'd be seminars or presentations. The idea always of the oral examination was to test if the work was actually yours. So I think the mechanisms are in place. We might see more of that being used. But most of us use a mix of assessment methods to try and get around this.
And Mary, just to, you know, my favourite thing to do on Twitter over the past few weeks, apart from, you know, the usual diet of winding people up, has been to constantly say, look, don't we have to be tough on the causes of SA Mills as well as, you know, tough on SA Mills? And you know, are we any closer to understanding why it is that students are turning to, you know, these services?
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I do feel that as universities do much more of their teaching and learning in smaller groups, you know, in the end, if nobody in the academic community in a university knows their students individually well enough to spot when they've turned in a sort of completely unusual piece of work, then we have a problem. But I feel like universities mostly are moving more towards a kind of slightly more personal approach to teaching and learning, you know, less of it happening in vast lecture theatres and so on. You know, I think in the end, the universities have a responsibility to know enough about their students to spot the ones who are struggling in the first place, and certainly to spot when, you know, when a struggling student suddenly turns in a word perfect, you know, 2-1 or first grade piece of work. I know that's kind of easy to say as an outsider, but it does seem to me that it in the end, universities need to tackle this at the root rather than, you know, banning SA Mills is one thing, you know, making it much more scary to go down that route, I think, is part of it. But student support, academic support, the ability to go to someone if you're struggling, feel that you will be supported is the key to it.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Do remember, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you'll find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Stephen, Mary, everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.